Howdy, everybody, and welcome back here to Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and of course, as always, Mr. Wu-Tang for life over here, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Hope everybody's doing good. Hope everybody's having a fun and safe week. I know it's the beginning of the week. We're starting out, but let's make it a good one, right? Let's make it a good one.
Heck yeah. I like that shirt, bro.
Oh, thank you. The Wu-Tang?
Wu-Tang forever, huh?
Represent. That's right.
I got my Star Wars on. Hey, you ready for the new one?
The new Star Wars movie?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I can't wait.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I can't wait.
The clips look pretty cool. I like the new lightsaber. Looks like an old
it's the Ulfbert like lightsaber.
It looks like an Ulfbert lightsaber, right? It's pretty cool.
Hey, I got something good, man. I got something good for you. I got something good for the listeners. The whole thing. Surely everybody's seen this. If not, everyone's going to enjoy this. I got this off IO9, but it's all been out in the news like crazy. Everybody's going to enjoy this, but the the headline that grabbed it for me was the best. New Discovery Channel president declares no more BS policy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's his new policy. Now, you and I have discussed in the past, and the listeners have chimed in and
What's
sent us a bunch
name?
Of stuff. Rich Ross.
Rick Ross. Every day I'm hustling,
yeah,
Rick Ross?
Yeah, Rich. Like Richie Rich.
This Rich is Ross. Rich Ross. Rich Ross. This must be his brother.
That's right. For real.
He's the one that's been behind this whole thing?
Rich.
It doesn't surprise me because Rick Ross is a phony himself, isn't he?
Well, he's taken the name from Freeway Rick Ross, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Wasn't he like actually a prison guard? His name's completely different.
Yeah,
and he
I
took
think
over
so.
This
yeah.
guy's name because he thought he was a gangster?
Yeah, I think so. That's
so
how that
Rich
went
Ross
down.
Is a phony too. That's why they've been putting out these crappy shows.
No. This guy is actually running a tight ship here.
Oh, he says
Rich Ross
it, right. He's saying this
he's
is the end of it.
He said this is it.
Well, good.
He's done with it. Now, we talked about this in the past.
Oh, it gets my blood going every time.
What did we say? The Mermaid Show, then Megalodon, then the Dyatlov Pass. Now, then you went all haywire on the Eaten Alive because of the joke here. And here's how it starts out. He says, if any of you have ever been angered by the Discovery Channel recently, and maybe for its completely erroneous Megalodon documentary, that it's probably done, even the snake thing. It's probably done because the new president, Rich Ross, has come out with it. Now, here's a few that they talk about, I guess would say quotes, is I don't think it's actually right for the Discovery Channel, is what he said, and that its type of programming, I think, like that, has run its course.
Absolutely. That was my complaint. It's not right for the Discovery Channel. And the Eaten by the Snake is completely different than the Mermaid and the Megalodon.
Mm-hmm.
The Dyatlov Pass, the Megalodon, and the Mermaids are mockumentaries that they're passing off as documentaries. It's made up footage and it's made up stories. I mean, like we've talked about before, the Dyatlov Pass is a real incident,
mm-hmm.
but they totally fabricated the Yeti part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's completely fabricated. And if you don't know that, you assume from now on that the Dyatlov Pass incident was a Yeti attack,
yes.
which is totally, it's erroneous. It's not real.
It's not real.
Now, the Eaten Alive by the Snake, that's actually a real show, but it's, they're mislabeling it. They're claiming that this guy's going to get eaten by a snake, and that doesn't happen. That's
yeah.
false advertising.
Well, he completely actually different. Quoted that, too. Put a quote out for that, Rich did.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, this is
Let me
here's
hear.
The quote. It was the right intention with a packaging that was misleading.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, he said that Paul, the man that was in it, cares deeply about snakes and wanted to draw attention to deforestation. He says you don't have to be so sensational. In his mind, he thought it was actually possible. But the fever of the story got out of control. And Rich goes on to say that I don't believe you'll see a person being eaten by a snake during my time here.
Well, good. But that's exactly what I was mad about is they labeled it as this yeah. guy's built a special suit. He's been eaten alive. That's why I tuned in. I wasted, you know, the 2 hours or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Because I thought this was going to happen. It's not happening. And then they're saying that he wanted to bring attention to deforestation by making a fake snake eating thing.
I think that was like the headline grab. And then I think it ended up going from what they intentionally wanted to do at first. Kind of, it snowballed and they got away from their main course. It's
yeah.
the same thing. I'll tell you what I equate it to. And folks, you may agree, you may not, but I equate it to Shark Week. I remember being a young man when Shark Week started and it was a great thing to watch. And now
I used to like it too.
It's not the same thing.
It's almost like they've run out of stuff to talk about.
Well, it's not just that. It's the fact that they've gotten away from the science of Shark Week. Shark Week used to be a very scientific approach. It used to be where it taught you about the shark. It taught you about lots of things. It didn't show all this breaching and all this. Yeah, you could say that's part
but even
of
the breaching,
science.
Though, when the first air jaws that came out, it was a new thing.
Yes.
We've never seen great white sharks doing this.
But this isn't.
But now they've done it. I mean, how many years in a row can I watch them jump out of the water? I got it.
That's not the point, though. The point is the fact that it's non-scientific. Just because you see them do it, all you do is then study it, that's fine. But they're not getting into some more of what Shark Week really was, in my opinion. They've gotten away from it.
Well, and I've read an article where legitimate oceanographers and guys that are studying these sharks, they're at the tip of South Africa. There's so many of these guide services now getting, they take tourists out to watch sharks breach that they can't even do their studies anymore because there's so many of these excursions going on. They're like, look, we can't even study here, people. Yeah. Look, people, do I come to your office and bother you? You know, we're trying to work here.
Rodney Carrington said, he goes, I don't come and throw rocks at you when you're doing your job. Why you got to come up here and yell at me? Yeah, that's right. So anyway, it's just a good thing. I'm glad to see that. Look, I'm a big fan, of course, of all the strange and unusual. We all know that. And we're all fans. If you're listening to this, you're fans of the such. But it's also good that Discovery now seems to have been maybe going back to what got them to the dance. And they seem to be a little bit more focused. And, you know, maybe it will be a better thing. Or at least maybe that if they approach these subjects in the future, that it's going to be a little bit more scientifically approached or a little bit more, I guess, approached with a little bit more respect than what they've been doing. So,
absolutely. Well, let's move on to some UFO news for the week. Did you see this? This is... This comes from openminds.net, TV.net, and this is by Roger Marsh, and it's talking about the multiple low-flying triangle UFOs have been reported over North Carolina.
Uh-oh, what's Micah doing?
I don't know. He's up to something over there, but he's in the bunker, so they can't see him.
Right? They're coming to visit.
Now, two North Carolina witnesses in Durham reported watching what appeared to be multiple triangle-shaped UFOs hovering and drifting in the area over a 1 hour and 25-minute period beginning about 9:20 p.m. on January 7th, 2015.
They may be coming to pick up Matt Oakley. That may be what they're coming to do.
Right? Now, the two people that spotted the first one were driving to a gas station in northern Durham when the first object was observed. And he says, my girlfriend and I witnessed an extremely bright hovering object, amber in color. We decided to drive around to get a better view of it over the treetops and witness what looked like a triangular light pattern, one very large. Very bright amber light in the nose and a smaller flashing light on each wingtip and the center, which stayed illuminated but strobed brighter in order from left to right. The object moved in the opposite direction of the car, it says. Now, he also says, because it was so far away, we couldn't make out any structure. The large light was unlike anything we had seen in the sky before in terms of its size and brightness. Now, once the object was out of view, they continued on to their gas station. And on the way back to the house, they encountered the object again, hovering close to its original position. He says, it was much closer, and we turned into the neighborhood to get a good look. The object was very close. I would compare it to watching a plane in a takeoff pass overhead in terms of its distance. As we pulled into the neighborhood, it stopped hovering and began moving. Drifting might be a more fitting verb across the sky towards us. Now, they parked their car and got out as the object passed directly overhead. I don't know if I would do that or not. It says, as it did, we both witnessed the solid black outline of an equilateral diamond, a small white running light in the center and at each tip, with an oversized amber-colored, seemingly directional, forward to and forward down light as its nose and a significant dimmer light on its tail. The three lights from wingtip to wingtip constantly strobed in a right-to-left direction as it moved away from us. The object was silent as it passed over and disappeared behind the tree line. He goes on to say, we jumped back into our car and tried to get a better angle to continue to watch it, but as we circled the woods which it passed over, it was nowhere in sight, until we happened to catch the faint strobe of the object now at a great distance away. Now they moved to another location to continue to watch the object. He says, we drove to my girlfriend's parents' house and watched the object glide back and forth across the sky at a great distance, like a commercial plane at altitude, for over an hour. At one point, her mother came outside to watch it pass at about 45 degrees above the horizon, close enough to make out the triangular front of the object. Now, she described it as, we kept noticing that it seemed to pass in a straight line until we could not see it anymore, and then it began its trajectory again from where it started, but we never saw it fly back. We assumed that we simply missed its return path. Finally, we watched one disappear, not behind trees, but simply in the distance. And we watched for its return, but we did not see it. And then again, suddenly the object was there again. And so they just watched it in disbelief. This total sighting, they said, lasted from 9:20 to 10:45 p.m.
Yikes.
And they don't know what it is now. I'm sure everyone that's into ufology and the study of UFOs has seen, like, the Belgian case and stuff. These triangles, black triangles with, like, tips, lights on each of the tips and usually one in the center. That's almost exactly what they're describing. But, you know, is this a military craft that they're seeing? Some kind of testing that's going on? I mean, there's nothing saying it has to be extraterrestrial just because it's unidentified.
It's true.
But what I find neat about the story is it's the same description almost every time. And it's almost always the same. It's almost behaving the same every time. So it's pretty odd. But anyways, that just happened. So if you want to check that out, I'll put links to it on the show notes.
Something's got to be going on because, like we've always said, there's too many stories that are too close to exactly the same. And the same behavior, the same look, the same everything that they're giving you. It does almost feel like it's a military-based thing, though. Heck, maybe it's one of those drones.
It could be.
You know what I'm saying? Maybe it's one of those drones. Hey, you and I have been talking about this off-air, so we're going to have to bring it up to the folks because this is making big news. Big news. And I think it's going to make even more news if the powers that be let it out. This comes from ancient origins, folks, but you can find it just about anywhere. But Miss April Holloway did a great job writing up this article. And the headline will pretty much tell you everything you need to know because it says, did humans walk the earth with dinosaurs? A triceratops horn dated to 33,500 years.
Right? Isn't that incredible? I read this article the other day.
It floors me because, like she brings up in here, now, the view is that all what they say dinosaurs, which I guess from the studies that they had done in the past, died out around 65 million years ago.
Right. That's what we're taught in school.
That's exactly what we're taught. But that this triceratops, this is a horn, a brow horn is what it is. So not the nose, but off of its brow, which is fitting for us talking about the dinosaur sightings in the Congo. And people talking about, you know, Mbilu, Mbilu, Mbilu. They start talking about this and this almost fits it. Now, this actually was found in Dawson County, Montana.
Right.
But it dated to 33,500 years ago. And crazily, and you even brought up, this isn't like the only one of its kind.
Right. That's what's so shocking
of this.
They're saying, now the article goes on to talk about how carbon-14 dating is how they've been dating stuff. It came out like in the early 50s or something. And there's tons of dinosaur bones that they never tested carbon-14 because they already knew, hey, look, this is a dinosaur bone. It's from 65 million years ago. What's the point in spending the money and work to try to carbon date it, right? So they just left them alone because everybody knows they were around millions of years ago. But apparently that's not the case. Recently, several scientists have actually been carbon-14 testing them.
Yes.
And what's shocking is all of them are coming up between like 35 and 55,000 years old only.
Yeah. Well, Hugh Miller is a man that is a research and consulting chemist and the head of the paleochronology group.
Right.
And he has the greatest quote. And it says it became clear years ago that paleontologists were not just neglecting to test dinosaur bones for carbon-14 content, but were refusing to do it.
Right. Now, if you're not familiar with C14 or carbon-14 dating, here's a little clip describing what it is.
Since the 1800s, dinosaur bones have been assigned ages according to their place in the geologic column. For dinosaurs, that is 65 to 230 million years ago. When carbon-14 dating became available around 1950, dinosaur bones were considered to be way beyond its detection limit of tens of thousands of years, so nobody bothered to test them with it. Carbon-14, or radiocarbon, is considered to be extremely reliable. Its accuracy has been verified by using it to date artifacts whose age is known historically. While an animal is alive, it takes in radioactive carbon-14. When it dies, the carbon-14 decays away over time. The amount remaining tells you how long the animal has been dead.
Now, see, let me be real clear here. We're not saying that all dinosaurs were only 33,000 to 55,000 years ago.
And that's not what this article is saying.
That's not what this article is saying either. No, there's definitely dinosaurs that were around millions of years ago. There's no doubt. You can tell by the strata that they're laid in and things like that. But what they are saying is as recent as maybe 55,000 years ago, or in this case of this triceratops, as recently as 33,000 years ago, they were still here.
They were here, yes.
And it's just like Cam talks about the sightings in the Congo and other areas. Maybe they're not now. Maybe Mukilombembe isn't alive now, but maybe as early as 40 years ago, it was still around. Who knows?
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of artwork all over the world that has depictions of stegosauruses, brontosauruses. You've seen them.
Yeah.
Whether it's in Peru or Bolivia, or you go over to India and other places. I mean, you can see
paintings. There's tons of stuff
in Asia with the dragons and things. Maybe some species survived until 33,000 years ago. Like maybe just stegosauruses and triceratops were around and all the other ones were gone. I'm not saying that, you know, everything was around. And maybe a couple pterosaurs like the ropins.
Well, exactly.
Or the
Indava
birds. Exactly right. We know mastodons and mammoths. I mean, they were all destroyed when the comet hit the Earth. Maybe they survived that long. And to me, that is incredible. And, you know, that's what this article is detailing. I couldn't believe it.
No.
This is not a one-off thing.
You're right.
Apparently, there's a whole group of people on this side that are fighting for this, and everybody else is like, no.
They just want to ignore it. They want it to go away because it goes against... I think there were a lot of assumptions made in the histories, especially whenever you go to teaching this. I mean, let me give you another example of it. Now, in March of 2005, in an issue of Science magazine, there was a woman named Mary Schwetzler, and she's a paleontologist, all right?
Uh-huh.
Now, her and her team had found, had actually used a Tyrannosaurus rex leg bone, all right, from the Hell Creek Formation there in Montana. Now, this leg bone was what they believed to 68 million years old, all right?
Okay.
That's what they believed at the time.
At the time, right.
What they did, though, was they actually found soft tissue inside it. And they know that soft tissue proteins degrade in less than 1 million years in the best conditions. Now, after they recovered the bone, the tissue was rehydrated by the science team, and testing revealed evidence of, get a load of this now, intact structures of blood vessels, bone matrix, and connective tissue.
Right. Okay.
So they're saying 68 million years, they're like, no, it wouldn't be there.
It's a,
so
a
they
million
know it has
years,
to be under a million years old.
That's right.
So that really, man, that just brings in so much more to question.
That to me is, it makes all the stories of the modern sightings of dinosaurs more believable to me.
Yes.
And even if, like we were saying, not all the species survived that long, maybe, but to go from, I guess, maybe some of them died at 100,000 years ago, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
To me, 65 million years to under 1 million years is a huge difference.
Yeah.
Right? You're talking 64 million year difference. That's a big
right?
jump right there.
Well, get a load of this. It says this challenge so far has been met with rejection, and previous attempts to publish carbon-14 test results were repeatedly blocked.
Right? See?
Now, you and I discussed this, and this was what was crazy, because the Center for Applied Isotope Studies at the University of Georgia, who conducted blind C-14 tests on the dinosaur bones without knowing that they were dinosaur bones, refused to conduct further C-14 tests after finding out that's what they were testing them on.
Right.
And the paleontologist Jack Horner, curator at the Montana State University's Museum of the Rockies, who excavated the T-Rex remains that the soft tissue was in, turned down an offer for $23,000 grant to carry out carbon-14 tests on its remains.
Right. Now, what's shocking is, or I guess it's not really shocking, that this is the exact same blowback that's happening in the archaeological world.
You're exactly
with,
right.
With like Robert Schock, when he came out with the Sphinx,
yeah.
and every, you know, Graham Hancock's work and stuff. All these other guys are like, no. And so they get stonewalled.
Yep.
I mean, and it seems to be happening in the paleontologist world too. It's exactly
years,
the same thing.
Well, this is what's going to break it out.
Right.
The sharing of this information, more and more people to see it, more and more people demanding it, writing emails, talking about it. This is what's going to break it out. It's one of those things that I know that there's creationalists that are going to be involved in this, and I know that there's people that are all scientific that are going to be listening to this and this whole thing. This is almost where they meet. But whether doesn't matter what your beliefs are, it doesn't matter any of that stuff. When you look at this and you realize, look, there's a scientific way of testing that shows that these things were around, like you said, 68 million years ago. They also show that they were around 33,000 years ago. We know that anatomically correct and modern human beings, as we are now, skeletal remains, have been found upwards to 180,000 years ago.
That's right.
Well, then we were there with them.
That's what I
these
think.
These depictions of
I
us
mean, you've heard,
with
you've seen
these
the,
creatures.
You've seen the dinosaur footprints with human footprints in them.
Mm-hmm.
And people have argued that that's always been a hoax for years.
Like it was carved in
that it. It was carved.
Yeah.
Somebody must have done it. It's more believable to me now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened. I mean, just not that far from where we're at in Glen Rose.
Yeah.
There are dinosaur footprints. You can go look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been there numerous times with my kids. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's the only spot I know of
it's
that you can go around and see dinosaur footprints.
Yeah.
Now, there's none there that I've seen that had human footprints in them. But it's neat just to see them because it's the only real contact you have. Like, you look at it and you're like, man, you know, I could read about dinosaurs in a book or I can watch Jurassic Park. But when you really see the footprint,
yeah,
being a hunter like myself, I'm familiar with tracking.
Yes.
You know, track marks of various animals. When you look at it, it's like, man, that is one big turkey right
there.
It
tells a story. It tells a heck of a story. Yeah. I love it. I think it's one of those things like we discussed off air about talking about Guiyang Padang, and that they believe now that it's around 26,000 years old of what they have found that was man-made. Well, then now you are really talking to putting it into where there was civilization of some sort, at least groups of people working together. And they were dinosaurs, and they were woolly mammoths, and they were, so it really is as wild and wacky as the land that time forgot, maybe before this last ice age.
It's incredible.
So, folks, if you want to, like I said, you can jump on Ancient Origins, or you can just do a search. Do a carbon 14 dating search and check it out and see what y'all think about it.
Now, speaking about dinosaurs, we're going to be talking to a gentleman after the break about some other creatures. Now, what kind of creatures are we going to be talking about, Cam?
A little bit of the goat fellers, some goat man stories.
Right, the goat man. Now, I'm a huge fan of the goat man, and as mentioned on this show before, we grew up, me and Cam, near Lake Worth. You know, it's really only like 19 miles from where we're at now. And when I was a kid, I was told of the stories of the goat man. You know, my uncles and other people would always tell you. But I only thought that the goat man was around here. I didn't know till later that there's goat man stories all over the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know.
And other parts
of
the world, even. And the guy that's going to be coming on tonight is Mr. Nathan Couch, J. Nathan Couch. And he just wrote a new book called Goat Man Flesh or Folklore. And this book's really cool. It's got stories from all over the U.S., different stories about the goat man. And he's going to chat it up with us. Now, J. Nathan Couch grew up in the foothills of northeast Georgia's Appalachian Mountains. Now, given the area's rich tradition of ghost stories and folklore, it's no wonder he developed a passion for the bizarre and the unexplained. So he's perfect for this show. Nathan is currently a resident of West Bend, Wisconsin, and he's written other books, including The Washington County Paranormal, A Wisconsin Legend Trip, and that was published back in 2002. And he wrote a fictional short story called Anna, which appeared in the 2013 WWA Press Anthology. A Wisconsin Harvest Volume 2. Now, when he isn't writing about ghosts or monsters, he's usually talking about them with Mike Hoke on The Strange Side with Mike and Nate, a weekly internet radio show that airs live each week on ztalkradio.com. So he's a fellow podcaster, too.
Yep.
And this book's amazing.
It's fun.
I love these stories. I mean, I could talk about the goat man and the satyrs and things like that. And some of the stories are downright creepy.
Well, and the thing I appreciate the most about the book, and I told him, I think, in the interview, too, is the fact that he ties the folklore together with some of these sightings and things. And then if he didn't find anything, it's not like he's building onto it. If he didn't find anything but more than a kind of an evil place or a place that's kind of just got some all-around bad energy going around there, and like we talked about with stripped cars and the place there in Denton and things, then he tells the story. It's not like he leaves that part out because it undermines the idea of there being a goat man physically running around there. No, he tells the whole thing, and I really appreciate that about the book.
I do, too. Very well researched, very well written.
Yes.
It's a great book. Stick with us, folks. Don't run off. We're going to get into with Mr. Couch about the goat man after the break. Stay with us. This is Expanded Perspectives. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special guest with us tonight, the author of the new book, Goat Man, Flesh or Folklore, Mr. J. Nathan Couch. Nathan, how are you doing today?
Oh, doing great. Just trying to survive one of these Wisconsin snowstorms.
Oh, man, I know. I've seen the weather stations. It looks really bad up there. It's a little cool down here, but really cold up there.
That's like a full-time job in itself, just getting through the snowstorm.
Yeah, it's been unusually cold lately. I think the high the other day was like, I don't know, like 3.
No, so. Thanks. No, there's thank
like,
you.
There was like a minus 22 degree wind chill. That's pretty brutal even for here. So
I need a goat man jacket is what you end up needing.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I do have some satyr legs from a Halloween party. So
nice.
They might work out.
Nice.
I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I mean, when I grew up, where me and Cam grew up, we're real close to Lake Worth. And so everybody has told us tales of the Lake Worth monster and the goat man and Greer Island and all that thing. But I had no idea until just a couple months ago that the goat man was not just a local phenomenon. It's, in fact, national and maybe international. That they've sightings of these things all over. And when I saw your book, I had to pick it up. And, man, there are some excellent stories in there. And it's really intriguing me. Can you tell us and our listeners a little bit, like, what got you started on this path? What got you interested in the goat man even to even start with?
Well, it's not unusual that you would not really know that there are goat men legends and encounters in other places. It seems like they're all over the place, but they're very regionalized. People in this town above me, Keewaskum, had never really heard of the version that's a little closer to West Bend, Wisconsin, where I'm living, and sometimes vice versa. So there's a weird compartmentalization with these goat man stories. But I first got into it because I heard about it at a Washington County Historical Society Halloween event several years ago. And when I heard that something resembling a Greek satyr from mythology was supposedly roaming around, you know, the hills of southeastern Wisconsin, The idea was just so bizarre. I immediately wanted to know everything there was to know about it. And then I contacted, eventually, a fellow that I found out about who claimed to have seen Goatman. And once I'd heard somebody had actually allegedly encountered this thing, I had to know everything about it I could.
Well, for sure. That's one of those things. Well, it got me interested just hearing about the whole idea, like you said, of a satyr being in the woods.
Yeah, I mean, these things are a very European phenomena. You know, I mean, ancient Greece, and you don't think about those things existing in the New World. The very idea of that is just so bizarre. But I mean, while a lot of areas seem to have a lot more goat man lore as opposed to actual sightings, there is quite a body of sightings all over the country, dating back all the way back to sometime in the 1830s. That was the earliest encounter that I came across.
Would you mind letting everybody know what a satyr actually, there's going to be some people that don't really understand what we're talking about when we say satyr. Could you kind of paint a description right quick of it?
Yep, a satyr or a satry, as some people call it, that wise in a strange place for us English speakers. They are basically ancient Greek nature spirits, half man, half goat. Originally in Greek mythology, they resembled half men, half horses. They were basically handsome young men with furry lower halves. Long ears like a donkey and a bushy tail. But once the Roman Empire kind of absorbed a lot of Greek mythology into their own pre-existing mythology, these Greek satyrs mixed with the Roman fauns, which were similar nature spirits, except they were half man, half goat. And ever since, Roman influence, the two creatures have been pretty inseparable in art and literature. And they were always depicted as being very worldly creatures. They hung out with the god of wine, Dionysus. They were usually drunk. They liked to sing and dance and try to fornicate with human women, goat females, nymphs, which were female nature spirits. So they were very lusty creatures.
The life of the party is what it sounds like they were.
Yeah, they weren't big intellectuals. There were some intelligent satyrs in the Greek myths, but for the most part, they thought with their lower brains.
Well, so. And we've had, people come on and discuss the sightings of dog men. And that was hard for some people to kind of even get an idea of. It's almost commonplace when they discuss sightings of Bigfoot now. But when you get into these other creatures, and the sighting that you talk about in the book of the satyr is one of those things that, man, I couldn't deal with it. Like this fella, there's no way I could deal with seeing something like that. Bigfoot, like we've always said, is something I'd be like, yeah, that's pretty awesome. But a dog man or a satyr, no, I'm out on, man. There's no, that sighting alone, there's no really way to explain. Can you? Would you mind telling the listeners about it?
Sure. Well, someone once asked me if I believed if goat men were real, and I said I'd have to see it to believe it, even after all this research, because they are such a strange thing. But I also said that I really hope I never see one, because it would be so strange that I'm worried that I might lose my grasp on reality. The sighting that the gentleman I interviewed here in Wisconsin, he was in Keewaskum, which is a little town 20 minutes of West Bend. West Bend itself is about 25 minutes north northwest, excuse me, from Milwaukee. So not too far off the beaten path, but a very small town. It's in the hills of the Kettle Moraines, which are very hilly, land formations made by the Ice Age. And there's a place called Goatman Road, which is back in State Forest, near the Milwaukee River. And you can go hunting back there, which is what this gentleman was doing, but also for decades it's been a place where teenagers go to drink and have some alone time with their dates. So there's an old house back in the woods there that the teenagers said Goatman lives in. It was actually put there in the 1940s by by the DNR, but they realized it was going to cost too much to hook it up to electricity, so they just kind of let it go to waste. And they said the goat man had moved into the place and he'd come out and terrorize you when you were back there with your girl. And this guy was back there hunting. It was during daylight hours. It was bow season. He was waiting on a buck to come through. He was up in a tree stand. And all of a sudden he hears some crashing coming through the woods. And he thinks, here comes, my trophy buck. He was getting all ready. And what came out into his field of vision, however, looked like a man that was naked from the waist up, human upper body. He had a long gray beard, but he also had horns like a goat. His lower half was two shaggy, grayish-brown, furry legs with backwards-bending knees, some type of goat or goat-like creature.
Yeah.
And it was actually speaking English. It was swearing and saying some really bad things. I don't even want to repeat them on, internet.
Yeah, right.
And the one thing I can say is it was complaining about trespassers, I believe. Yeah, trespassers. And It got out of his field of vision. One thing he also described was it had a terrible smell. He described it as being like dead animals and rotting garbage. And once it got out of his field of vision, he waited a minute or two, climbed down out of the tree, and ran out of there with his bow and arrow ready in case anything chased him. And he doesn't go hunting over there anymore. So
yeah, I don't blame him. That's bizarre. I mean, just the description alone and then the way it was cursing and stamping around about
trespassers.
That's my
favorite part, is this mad little goat cursing, stomping around in the woods. I'm like, that's awesome.
Right? That's crazy.
Yeah, and he described it as being pretty man-sized. Every now and then you'll hear an encounter where these things are like 4 foot tall or sometimes even smaller, but it sounded like this one was pretty substantial. It seems like these creatures have a wide variance in appearance. Sometimes they look like a hairy humanoid, but with the backwards bending legs and horns. And sometimes they're described as 6-7 feet tall, other times 4 feet tall. So there's not a real uniform appearance for these things.
It's also hard to misidentify a half man, half goat cursing in the woods that's 6 foot tall.
I know, and every now every
it's not
now,
like, oh, it was a calf. No, I don't think so.
I know, and I mean, ever since the book came out, every now and then I'm approached by somebody via email or something where they've had an encounter. And they didn't know. I didn't have a word to describe what it was until they've heard me talk about these things or read the book or what have you. And I'll post those on my website occasionally, and then inevitably people like, oh, it was a deer. That's just as implausible seeing a goat man as that a sane, person who was not under the influence of any type of drugs could see a four-legged deer and think it was a half man, half goat.
Right?
I can't imagine the circumstances that would make one appear as the other.
Well, and the thing I appreciated the most about the book was the fact that it opened my eyes to some stories of these creatures in Texas that some of them I had no idea about. I mean, like we said, I've been to the woods there for the Lake Worth Monster. We've grown up on the lake. But you talked about, it's almost like there was a whole section, like we drew, the Lone Star State drew you in with some of these stories of these creatures. I didn't realize we had that big a problem with them down here.
Yeah, it seems like I mean, there's three chapters on Texas alone in the book, which really surprised me. I mean, going in very early into my research, I found out about the Lake Worth Monster and the Goat Man of White Rock Lake in Dallas, and Goat Man's Bridge over in Denton. Those are the big three, and just to have three big legendary creatures like that, they're so similar in a relatively close space is unusual. But then, you know, all over the state, there's just all these stories. And Texas is a big state, 254 counties. And I'm sure if I was given enough time and, resources, I could probably find at least 254 different goat men stories.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. It's almost like every county has its own little tale, its own of something going on. And it's funny, like you say, because it seems to tie back in to the goat men. Out of the three that you've got, which is your favorite that you had here in Texas? Do you have a favorite one?
I really had a good time researching the Goatman Bridge in Denton, not only because, well, the Goatman there is primarily described as a paranormal phenomena, pretty much a ghost. And, there was a lot of strangely, strangely detailed, little tidbits attached to this story, like with dates, that I was really able to go in, find a huge stack of old Denton newspapers, and then, were there really missing persons reported on, January 6, 1967, or whatever date it was? And so it really gave me something I could really dig into, and I did find that I didn't find necessarily any missing persons on that date, but I did find out that there were cars abandoned there a lot of times that were stolen. I did find out that a young lady did go down there and commit suicide. They found her quite on accident while they were searching for a missing child. So that was something that was completely missing from, the lore of the place when you go to, strangenews.net and they run an article about Goatman. Nobody really ever mentioned this young lady's unfortunate demise. So I think that was something that may have possibly influenced the legend, and people just had forgotten about or never really quite uncovered it.
It seemed like there was a lot of negativity involved in that whole area, like you're talking about, that whole deal. Well, can you give the folks a rundown of the lore? What was actually, what drew you to it? What was the folklore of that area?
Yeah, the story is that on a certain date, I think in the late 60s or something, they started finding abandoned cars near this bridge. And they claim that the people's bodies were never found. I never verified that any of that happened. I did find out that there were abandoned cars found there that had been stripped of their gear, sometimes set on fire. The place is supposed to be haunted by a ghost called the Goatman. And there's a lot of different origins for him. The most famous is that he was a man named Oscar Washburn, who was supposedly a African-American who moved into the area near that bridge with his family, began selling goats, and proved very popular. Allegedly, his popularity was not appreciated by the local Ku Klux Klan, so supposedly they went, got him, dragged him down to the bridge, hanged him over the side. And then in something that's definitely pure urban legend, when they threw him over the side, the tension from the rope supposedly severed his head. And then his ghost returned and confused, looking for its own head, took the head from one of his goats and used it instead. That's no way that part of the story ever actually happened. But That name, Oscar Washburn, also gave me something to dig into. And he was a real living person, but he lived quite a long ways away from the bridge. And he was involved in a murder. He was actually killed by, I believe it was, a brother-in-law after he had whipped his wife. And So I don't know how his name became attached to Goatman Bridge. But he was a real living person, and that surprised me. I didn't think I would. I thought maybe that was a name that just pulled out of thin air.
And tons of negativity involved in that whole area.
Yeah, yeah. It's that place has been investigated by some you know, writers from Fate magazine, some pretty well-known paranormal groups, and a lot of evidence has been collected. And even before that bridge existed, and it's existed a very long time, it's in the town of Denton, Texas. You know, there, before that bridge even existed, the location of the bridge was a shootout between law enforcement and the Sam Bass gang. So that particular body of water has had a pretty morbid history since before, you know, there was even much of a settlement there.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of negativity tied to that area. Since we're talking about Denton, Texas, and we live so close to Lake Worth, I was going to have you describe to the audience the story of the Lake Worth monster and what you found out during your research on that.
Sure. That whole thing started in during the summer of 69, and every time I say that, I hear Brian Adams in my head. But it started in the summer of 69, and Lake Worth, I don't know if it still is, but back in the 60s, it was a place where couples went to go make out, and there was three couples down there. And something jumped on the hood of their car. They described it as looking like a scaly, a goat man covered in fish scales, I believe is how they described it. And it reached through the window after this one guy's wife, and he floored it out of there, and they had a bunch of scratches on their car afterwards. And these couples were so traumatized by what happened, they went flying into town to the police station. And the police were so struck by what they were telling them, several, I think three, maybe even four or five squad cars responded, and Goatman fever broke out, basically. And the police admitted in the newspaper that for several months they had been getting reports of a monster out there, but they just thought it was, you know, hoaxes and teenagers and crank calls and all that. And the very next night, some 40 people saw it because everybody went out looking for the thing. And these two carloads of people saw it up on a bluff. And as they stopped to watch it, more and more people just happened by as they were looking for the thing. And a posse of them went up the hill to try to, you know, corral the thing. And it threw a car tire at them some 500 feet. And it was a car tire that had been discarded on top of the bluff. It still had the wheel of the car in it. So wheel well. And so to throw that 500 feet is pretty impressive. And the crowd yeah. stopped pursuing it at that point. It disappeared into the trees. The police showed up, and they were kind of making fun of the crowd when there was a very loud howl, and very strange howl, and the cops actually retreated to the squad car, which I think is pretty entertaining since they were kind of with the onlookers. And that was seen a lot more that summer. The last time it was seen was actually in November of that year. There was a man sleeping in the back of his pickup truck. He woke up with this thing lifting him into the air. He quickly grabbed a bag of leftover fried chicken that was next to him, shoved it in the thing's mouth, and then it dropped him and swam away with the chicken toward Greer Island, which is where it was thought to live, this little island out in the middle of the lake.
Uh-huh.
And nobody's really seen it since. There's been sightings of similar creatures elsewhere in Texas, but for the most part, nothing else not much anyway that I've heard of coming out of Lake Worth.
Yeah, that's the story is exactly what I remember being told as a youngster. Is exactly like even some of the Sasquatch sightings they've linked to possibly being the Goat Man or vice versa, or Skunk Ape and stuff. There's like a nature preserve mm-hmm. near there, and I think that there's even today there's people that still claim they have sightings of something, or they smell like a skunk ape or something, and it's always, oh, it must be the goat man. But it's a really interesting story, and the thing I like about all the stories is there seems to be a common thread. It almost is like wherever these couples are going and making out and stuff, that's where this goat man seems to kind of always show up, regardless of where it is in the U.S. or wherever. It seems like that's a common thread. Do you think the same thing?
He has seen in some locations that aren't necessarily party locations. Some places he seems to hang out around Boy Scout camps. You know, that makes sense, though, considering, that it's a fun thing to tell creepy stories around a campfire. Right. You can see how legends like that are attached to certain locations. But mostly he is a lover's lane monster. He does seem to appear where people like to party. don't know that it necessarily has anything to do with Greek satyrs from mythology, but it certainly does fit their MO, considering that they were, you know, pretty passionate creatures. They liked wine, women, and song. So I could see how, you know, some kids out drinking and making out with their girlfriends could possibly trigger it.
Yeah, so I mean,
if they are in fact related to Greek mythology.
So. Well, you're right, and it is fitting. I mean, that's what they were known for in Greek mythology, and it does seem weird that when is it? I wonder. You know, they always say that like poltergeist activity comes around a lot of teenagers and stuff because of the hormones and it's almost is that activity drawing this in? Is it really something from a different dimension that's somehow drawn to it, or is this just an urban legend created by parents to keep their kids some form of safe sex? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that where these monsters exist, they do serve a particular purpose in their community. One, I forget the name of the town, but there's one specific community in Texas where the town is by some railroad tracks. So if you go wandering down by the railroad tracks, Goat Man gets you. Another place, if you go down by the water swimming at night, Goat Man gets you. Here in Wisconsin, he's seen on a really dangerous stretch of road called Hogsback Road, and he's supposed to run out in front of you, cause an accident, and then drag you away. So it's almost like it's warning, you know, kids not to go joyriding on a curvy, hilly road. So he does function as a boogeyman in certain locations. But, you know, I could see how the legends could grow out of something like that. But none of that really I mean, some of it is definitely 100% folklore. There's no doubt about it. Like the part about the guy taking the goat's head and using it as his own. That's definitely something right out of like an old comic book. But it doesn't explain what people are seeing, you know, because especially considering that some of these Goatman sightings occurred, you know, in the 1800s, far, far earlier than, you know, some of the instances. Well, Lover's Lane legends as a whole were allegedly originated in Texarkana, Texas, when the Phantom, this fellow who wore a burlap sack over his face, he was a very real person. He was going around murdering teenage couples. They were having sex in public.
Yeah, they're fixing to release a movie on that, I believe.
Yeah, well, yeah, they released one in the 70s. It was a Charles B. Pierce movie about the town that dreaded sundown, and now they're making it. So, you know, the Lover's Lane urban legend really started in the 50s and the 60s in suburban, you know, America. But, you know, some of these goat-like creatures were being seen in 1830 or 1912. So I think urban legend can explain a lot of the stories, but not many of the sightings.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're talking about time well before social media. I mean, how would you have all these different sightings that are so much alike in different parts of the nation? And just like the first story you told us about the hunter, I mean, he saw something physical. And, I mean, that must be terrifying. So, I mean, I don't know. I would be terrified. I'd much rather see a Sasquatch than I would a goat man.
It would be easier to take. Somehow seeing Bigfoot, I think, I mean, all of this Freudian stuff is, can make certain people say, oh, well, that person's just insane. They're trying to get attention. But I think seeing something like Bigfoot or a UFO or a lake monster is somehow socially more acceptable than seeing a goat man. You know, if the guy that says he saw Bigfoot is getting ribbed, imagine how bad the goat man witness is getting treated.
For real.
Yeah.
Have you received any more sightings since you've released the book?
I've received several. I've heard of a couple here in you know, in Wisconsin, in Keewaskum, where the first creature that got me interested in all this was sighted. He was about a 4 foot tall. This fellow was in his home in rural Keewaskum, and he heard a gunshot. He thought his neighbors were firing coyotes, which is a relatively common thing apparently in his neighborhood. He looked out the window by the snowmobile trail. This was in winter, expecting to see some coyotes running down the trail, and instead he saw a grayish brown shaggy creature about 4 foot tall, running extremely fast and efficiently in high snow, and it had a head like a horse. So not exactly a goat man, but strange enough where I could see how if somebody saw something like that, they could think it was Goatman.
For real?
And, yeah, and there was a sighting here in September of this year of a creature. A woman sent me a sketch of it, which is up at the blog on jnathancouch.com. She was kind enough to let me post it. And it was it looked almost like an extraterrestrial. It had kind of like an oval, like gray alien-type head. Had its elbows very low on its forearms. And it had backwards-bending legs. It was grayish-brown and hairless, muscular, and ran out in front of her car, scared her and her teenage daughter to death. And then it braced for impact because it thought it was going to get hit. So they didn't get to see its face or its hands or its feet. And then it scurried off into the woods. And this was near Holy Hill, a location that's had some pretty high-profile, anomalous Bruin sightings and some alleged Bigfoot activity in the previous decade.
I mean, how would you misidentify something like that? What could that possibly be?
And
the fact that, all right, it braces for impact, the whole thing, like it was expecting, yep, I'm fixing to get it right here, and it didn't. I mean, how would you misidentify something even running with its legs bent backwards? I don't know of anything that's legs bent backwards that stands up upright and runs.
Yeah, I mean, somebody said that told me that there's a gentleman that lives in that area who has some, you know, mental problems, and he wears a strange hat and wanders around, and he looks almost inhuman until your car gets right on top of him. And I'm like, well, if that's him, I hope he's not roaming around at night in a really cold, you know, Wisconsin autumn, naked with his legs pointing the wrong direction.
Yeah. I don't care how odd.
I mean, it's not. That's not a satisfactory explanation.
Right.
And then somebody snidely remarked, oh, it was the, quote, ass end of a deer. I'm like, you know, that's just as implausible as when the Lake Worth monster sightings was happening, some naturalist claimed it was a bobcat. There's no bobcat that looks like a goat man or a Bigfoot or that looks like it has scales.
Yeah.
And there's no human being mentally challenged or otherwise who looks like a backwards-legged extraterrestrial. So it hasn't been officially explained to me. I don't know that it was a goat man, but I'm not buying that it was, you know, someone with mental problems either. So.
Right, Nathan. Now, I know up there in Wisconsin there's a lot of Native Americans. Is there any tie between the goat man and what some people have referred to the dog man and other things as? Could it be possibly skinwalkers? Has anyone ever made that connection? That somehow Native Americans are shape-shifting. That's why you're getting the man body with the animal head or animal body with a human head. I mean, those types of things.
Well, the witness from the September sighting out by Holy Hill did remark that its legs looked canine. She described its backwards bent legs looking canine rather than goat-like. But these strange canine-like creatures are usually seen in places that were once or currently are sacred to Native Americans. Linda Godfrey made that connection in several of her books. But these strange goat men, I mean, there are mounds, strange effigy mounds, in several Midwestern states, especially in southeastern Wisconsin, that were built by a group of people who are mysterious. They just refer to them as mound builders. No one really knows who they are. People used to theorize that they were of the lost city of Atlantis, and nowadays most people agree it was probably the ancestors of the Potawatomi or the Menominee Indians. But some of these effigy mounds they built in southwestern Wisconsin were in the shape of human beings, and almost all of the human being-shaped mounds had large goat-like horns coming out of their heads. Some people theorize that these were stylized buffalo headdresses, and other people theorize they were depictions of a Native American hero called Red Horn. But we do not know if the mound builders knew the story of Red Horn, and we do not know that the mound builders wore buffalo headdresses. We know that, you know, the more modern tribes wore those type of headdresses, but we don't know for a fact that the mound builders wore those. And the only one that still really exists is Man Mound in Baraboo, Wisconsin. And it very much looks like a Greek satyr. If anybody's got Google next to them while they're listening to this, just look at the Baraboo Man Mound in Wisconsin. And when you see it, you're definitely going to think more of a goat man than a guy in a buffalo headdress.
That I'm going to have to check that out,
because
that is crazy sounding.
Yeah, and of course, out in Maryland, there was a deity called Oki that the Piscataway and the Powhatan Indians worshipped, and he was described by Europeans as resembling a devil. Now, whether or not that meant that he was just scary looking, or whether that meant he actually had some goat-like qualities, I don't know. But I do know the Powhatan Indians did wear antlers on their head when they performed ceremonies to Oki. So, could be a connection
could
there
link,
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And those tribes did exist in an area where there's a lot of goatman lore. I think Prince George's County, Maryland is probably the most famous goatman location in the United States. Their particular version of goatman having been featured in several movies and in comic books and various documentaries.
Well, Nathan, have you received any, I guess you could say, pushback or blowback from any of the, like, the regular Bigfoot investigators or things like that for releasing, you know, information and not kind of giving credit where they may think it's due?
I have not, but there is a lot of Bigfooters think these goatman sightings are happening because a Bigfoot is wandering into an area where goatman legends exist. And that doesn't really jive with me, because I don't believe you can properly solve a mystery by introducing a different mystery. Until someone, you know, finds either a living or dead specimen of Bigfoot and these things enter, you know, the realm of known animals, I don't think we can say, well, you know, that was just a misidentified Bigfoot. I mean, it is true that a lot of the sightings of these things sound a lot just like hairy humanoids. Some of them, like hardly any of the sightings of the Maryland Goatman describe goat qualities. They do sound like a Bigfoot creature.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the Lake Worth monster sightings after the initial sighting described a Bigfoot-like creature. But, you know, like I said, I don't think we can really explain one mystery with another.
Now, I agree. That's kind of what I figured you was going to end up going with. It's one of those deals that a lot of them, they want to answer it with what they want to answer with, or they act like you're crazy because people think that they've seen a dog man. Well, is that any more out there than it would be to see a Bigfoot? In my opinion, no. I mean, we don't know. I mean, you're speculating on things that we have, you know, no idea about. And I hate it when people aren't, I guess, more open-minded as far as what kind of crypto creatures could be out there. We don't know. And like you're talking about with that sighting the guy had, the bow hunter had, it's unbelievable to me that's not a Bigfoot. That's
it was
not
speaking English.
Speaking English. I mean, when you're bow hunting, you're pretty close to your prey, so you're going to be able to see it very clearly. And when it came by, he got the vibe. He could smell it. I mean, that's something that you don't really, like I said, and it doesn't sound like, I mean, you spoke to the man. I mean, you could tell more than anybody if it sounded like he was making it up. And it didn't really, knowing that he's not really getting a lot of publicity for it because he didn't really want it out there. I mean, Kyle and I have talked to several people along the same lines that have told us stories, but they don't want their names used. They don't even want their stories talked about on air. They just told Kyle and I because they just want to get it off their chest. And you can really tell, you're like, man, why would you make something up that nobody was going to know about but one other guy?
Right. I mean, this gentleman did give me his name and allowed me to use his name. We did, the local newspaper, when the book came out, did try to reunite me and him for a news story about the book, but he's kind of dropped off the map. So he's got it off his chest. He doesn't want to talk about it anymore. But yeah, the one thing that really gets me in the Fortean world is, I mean, I run a paranormal history tour business here in West Bend, Wisconsin. And so I have a lot of people who are enthusiastic about ghosts on my page. So I'll share something like when I shared the story about the September sighting.
Mm-hmm.
Of that strange creature by Holy Hill. A lot of people made fun of this woman, but they were there because they believe in ghosts. And that kind of thing drives me crazy.
Right, yeah.
And like Bigfoot guys, you know, rag on the UFO community, and the UFO guys rag on this community. And it seems like, if you believe in something like Bigfoot or Goatman or Ghost, you can't really rag on somebody else's, you know, beliefs. You don't necessarily have to believe them. Just because you believe in ghosts don't mean you have to believe in that there's a goat man or a Bigfoot out there. But I don't think you should question their sanity either. That's something that really gets me. So,
well, go ahead and tell folks about your tour thing. Where can people find that? Is it on your website?
Yeah, jnathancouch.com has information about the downtown West Bend ghost walks. They start normally in May and go all the way into November, even with the terrible Wisconsin falls. So, and then, of course, you know, jnathancouch.com has information about the books and interviews like this and all that sort of thing.
Are you planning on another book coming up soon?
I am. I have three different ideas in my head, and I don't know which one's going to win out. I think there's two that are leading the pack now, and I'm probably only going to have a chance to write one of them at a time. So I definitely wanted – I came across a lot of other strange creatures similar to Goatman but different during my Goatman research, and I would like to incorporate that in some way into my next project, whatever that may be.
Have you – so you were talking about the ghost and things that you're into the paranormal. Have you ever had an experience with that yourself?
I have. I've had several, but the most I'd never really seen an apparition until two summers ago. I was on my summer vacation. We went to Mammoth Cave National Park down in Cave City, Kentucky, the central part of the state. And the cave itself was supposed to be haunted. They found mummies, and there was a tuberculosis hospital inside the cave where people died and all sorts of things like that. And we did a tour, and there's 100 people per tour, so we didn't see anything. And then we went on a nature trail there. And my wife was looking at some wild flower plant that caught her attention. She asked me what it was, and I can't tell you a geranium from a fern. I had no idea what it was. So I'm like, I don't know. And so then she started walking on down the trail, and it was just before twilight. There was still a lot of light, and there was a nice breeze, and I was just standing there kind of letting my eyes unfocus, staring at these plants, when right in front of my face – well, not in front of my face, but just directly in front of these plants, just, I don't know, maybe two arms lengths away from me, I saw a woman's face, clearly defined, gray or sepia tone like an old photograph. She had a narrow, thin face, angular jaw, thin nose, dark hair in a bun on top of her head with one curl hanging down on her forehead, and she was just floating there. She didn't blink or move, or it was just like somebody took a snip of an old photograph and put it in front of me. And I turned and started walking away because it was almost like my brain couldn't handle what I was seeing, like it almost didn't register. And then like a split second later, I'm like, holy cow, and I turn around and look, and there's nothing there. And that part of the park has no paranormal activity associated with it whatsoever. So you never know when something thoroughly bizarre is going to happen to you.
Well, if anyone has any Goatman encounters or anything they'd like to share with you, is there any place that they can email you, or is it just go to your website? Or
Yeah, there's several contact forms on jnathancouch.com, and I have a couple of different Facebook pages that have links up on that website as well. You can contact me through there also. Goatman Flesher Folklore has a Facebook page itself. So you can either get me on Facebook or through email from that website.
Well, thank you so much, Nathan, for coming on. And when you get one of those new books out, you're going to have to come back on Expanded Perspectives and talk to us about it.
All right, I'm getting a book out about every 2 years, so I'll probably see you again in 2016.
That'll be perfect, man. That's fine. That'll be perfect. That was awesome. It'd be great. Yeah.
That's right. The book is Goatman, Flesh or Folklore by J. Nathan Couch. I suggest you pick it up. It's an excellent book. I love stories like these. If you're a fan of Expanded Perspectives, you will love it too. Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Hope you really enjoyed it. We had a wonderful time talking to Nathan. It was a good time. Man, like I said, I enjoy the stories. I enjoy the people that really dig into all this stuff. He was just another one of the guys that we had on. It's a lot of fun. Man, off air, he was fun. I mean, he's a good, good guy.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy. And I suggest if you're interested in cryptozoology or the Goatman, or you're just starting out getting interested in cryptozoology, go ahead and go to Amazon, get the book. It's called Goatman, Flesh or Folklore. And like I said, you can listen to him. He's a fellow podcaster, too, an internet radio show.
Yeah.
Listen to The Strange Side with Mike and Nate. I mean, it's pretty good.
Well, and I like the fact, like you said, if you're into cryptozoology, it's always fun to add to your collection. And that book would be great to throw in there with the collection. I mean, that fits right in there with Linda Godfrey's books and all that.
That's so. Right. And he even asked us, you know, please urge your listeners, if you have any stories that you'd like to forward to him, just go to jnathancouch.com.
Yeah.
Also, he's a contributor at thecultoftheweird.com. You can go there.
Yeah.
And you can email him, and he'll get a hold of those stories. And heck, Maybe you'll be in his next book, because he said he's working on something else. He wouldn't give us the details.
Yep.
But he's going to come back on when he's finished with that. So.
Yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be real fun. Well, Kyle, I had something strange happen to the family. And I guess I'm going to go ahead and talk about it in a whole deal. I wasn't sure if I was going to. And I say it didn't happen to me. It happened to my son. But before I get into that, I want to talk about this story to kind of add something to this. All right. Now, this actually comes from SunstarSolutions.com. All right.
Uh-huh.
This is a Bigfoot sighting that took place near Las Cruces, New Mexico. Now, this happened December 5th of 2001. Now, this Las Cruces, for people that don't know, was just north of El Paso up in New Mexico. But it was actually wintertime, okay, when all this went down. Okay. I'm sorry, I lied to you. It was submitted in December. I got ahead of myself. It actually took place right around Thanksgiving of 2001. But it says, we were camping for Thanksgiving week. There were three adults, two teenagers, and two small children. It says, my 14-year-old son was outside in the night getting me something from our SUV when he turned to see what he described as an 8-foot-tall humanoid-shaped figure walking south in the half moonlight. He had no flashlight to look closer. But when he saw it, he got scared and ran into the trailer where we all were. The weather was fairly cold, just a little above freezing, if I remember right, and it was just after a sandstorm had passed through 2 days before. All was clear with a few clouds in the sky that night. Once inside, he told us, and we laughed, and we thought he was joking. And then we suggested that perhaps, because of its size, that it was Bigfoot. And I have a friend who knows or knew some people and had heard of at least 4 Bigfoot sightings in the El Paso Franklin Mountain area over the last decade or so, especially in the Anthony Gap Pass on the north side of the Franklin Mountains outside of El Paso. So anyway, it was not unheard of to know of Bigfoot sightings in the desert, even though they usually live in forested areas. We have, within an hour's drive of there, many forested and wooded areas in the mountains all over New Mexico, and it's not a far reach to think that they would roam outside of their territory on occasion, especially in the dark of night. Said, so after we all had a good laugh at my nephew, who's 18, he took my nephew that was 18 took a flashlight, and they stood just outside the trailer looking to see if they could see this 8-foot-tall figure that my son claimed to have seen. Just then, although they didn't see anything, they heard a very large growl. Like a warning sound of an angry type growl, along with a shuffling of the dirt or digging of the dirt with a foot, which reminded my nephew of a bull scraping the dirt with its foot just before it runs towards you. Well, the boys freaked out completely, ran inside the trailer, falling down and slamming the door behind them all at the same time. They were yelling and absolutely convinced that whatever it was that was outside made the growl. I asked a series of questions, still not believing that they weren't trying to fool us, and I could plainly see that Derek was totally freaked out and absolutely unwilling to go outside anymore. He was truly afraid, and it was then that I realized it was real. I suddenly got this feeling that we were in danger, although I had not heard of a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot attacking anyone before, except for the ones that, you know, threw rocks. So we just stayed inside, peeking out the windows with flashlights, trying to see anything, but alas, no such luck. But then, perhaps because of the growl, it was for the best that we didn't see anything. And after a while, I felt the danger feeling pass and all was okay. Even though we were all locked the door in the trailer and our friend, who sleeps in his car, locked his car during the night, the boys drove back to Las Cruces to spend the night because they were too afraid to stay with my nephew and he had to work the next morning. Nat said that they checked the air for physical evidence and because of the blowing sands and all that stuff, that they didn't find anything, but that there has been a lot of sightings in this area, and there's a lot of BLM land for those of you that's a Bureau of Land Management, which is kind of like untouched, almost like public lands. Everybody can go and camp and hike and all that through that area. Well, I tell you this story because my son was gone from New Year's Eve until, what was it, the 7th, I guess, 8th when he got back?
Yes, mule deer hunting.
Mule deer hunting in New Mexico. And he was in a little, basic little flat spot in the road called Queen in that area.
Bow hunting, too. Bow hunting, not with a gun.
Yeah, just bow hunting. Him and my nephew and my two brother-in-laws. And if you look at Las Cruces, and you actually have to stay on the road because it's all a bunch of rough, rugged land between Queen and Las Cruces, to get there by highway, driving and winding around, it takes a little over 4 hours. But if you were to draw a straight line, if you were to walk, you know, or if you could drive straight through, it probably wouldn't take but a couple, you know. So I would probably say it would be less than 200 miles, maybe 150 miles between the two, as a, you know, as they say, as a crow flies. I tell you all this because
My son comes home. He's like, Dad, I got to ask you something. He goes, something happened to me. And I'm like, all right, what was it? And I'm expecting him to tell me typically what you would expect. I saw something in the sky. You know, I'm in New Mexico, out in the middle of the night. We saw something. And when I say they were standing there, I mean, they were camping in tents. It was cold. It had snowed. I mean, it was rough. They were staying in tents. And I expected them to be up. And, you know, he saw something in the sky. He's like, no. He said, I was hunting in a draw, big ravine type area. And he said, I was watching, hoping that the mule deer would funnel out in this certain area. And his uncle, my brother-in-law, he had left him and circled way out and went on a whole nother place. And they were circling around trying to see if at any point maybe he pushed some deer out. He said it started getting dark and they were supposed to meet at the trucks. And so Brandon's like, well, he goes, I haven't seen anything, you know, aside from a few at distance and all that stuff. So he's like, I'm gonna make my way back to the truck. And he said he was walking along. And he said it was right at dark. He said, where it was that funny type of light where you can still see, but not perfect. You know, it's right when the sun's setting. He said, you can still see, but it's not great. You can see kind of the glow around you. And he heard a whistle. Oh, is exactly what he said.
Really?
And he was like, okay. Well, he figured it was my brother-in-law, Jimmy. He figured it was his uncle. And he was like, oh. And he said, it wasn't like a long ways away because it was like 20 foot right in these cedars. So Brandon stopped and just stood there. And he said about 10 seconds passed and he whistled back at him. And he said, nothing. So he was like, So Brandon said he just kind of squatted down and slid back first up into these little cedar trees. He said it was pretty open. He's looking right at the tree line that it come out of. It's just cedar breaks and rocks and scrub brush. And he said he's 20 foot from where that whistle came from, he thought. So he's looking around and, you know, it whistled and he whistled back. He said he didn't say anything and he was looking. He didn't ever turn his flashlight on. He said he had his backpack. He said you could see. It was, you know, clear enough at night you could have seen where he was going. And he said about 3 minutes went by is what he said. And then he hears again.
Ooh.
And he goes, this time he's zoned in. He said it's like firing two shots. Like they used to always tell you, don't ever shoot twice. Yeah. The Indians will find you, you know. Type,
he's triangulating
type.
The
boom. He knows right position. Where the sound is. So Brandon's like, he's squatting and he's staring. And he says, now I'm waiting because I'm thinking, why isn't Jimmy saying something? Why isn't, you know, even if it's not him, if it's another guy out here hunting, which there's nobody around him, he's like, nobody's saying anything. So Brandon said he waited about 10 minutes. He said, I'm crouched in there.
I bet that was the longest 10 minutes.
Oh, he said, well, and that's what I'm thinking. He said it felt like it was forever, but I'm like, was it really 10 minutes or did all this go down in about five, really? Because we know how that everything seems to slow when you're on edge. And he said, it's one of those type of nights where you can hear your blood pressure in your ears.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sound. And he goes, that's what he thought was kind of odd was there's no sound of anything in the area. No coyotes, no birds, no nothing. There's nothing making noise. And Brandon said, so he went, just changed the whistle up. And he said, this time it whistled just like him. And it was about 20 or 30 yards farther away, straight in front of him. That it was moving away from him now, and it whistled just like him, except the strange thing was he never heard nothing move. He said, you can't walk through here. He said, there's crunchy snow, there's, you know, moving rocks. He's like, it's tough to walk in there in silent. And he's like, I'm not going and, you know, making assumptions or things like that, but he was like, it would be very, very, very difficult for anybody to walk around out there and not make a sound.
Right.
So he was like, well, at that point, he freaked. He was like, whoa, you know, and he's like, all right, I'm not down with this. So he's like, and he said, I had an arrow knocked the whole time, you know, and he's like, okay, something's up. So he just slipped on out and he went on back and worked his way up towards the truck. And when he got to the truck, my brother-in-law was already there sitting on the tailgate waiting on him. And he's like, hey, did you whistle at me? He goes, what are you talking about? My brother-in-law's like, what are you talking about? And he's like, are you messing with me? Now you've got to know my brother-in-law. He's a really dry individual.
Mm-hmm.
He's cut and dry. He's no nonsense kind of guy. He's fun, but he's no nonsense, especially when it comes to anything in the outdoors. He doesn't play around. He's one of those, no, there's no playing around. It's serious business.
Yeah.
Somebody will get hurt. Nothing. That's the first thing he said is he goes, I don't do that. He's like, I don't think it's funny. I don't think it's funny to mess with people out here. He goes, that's how people get hurt. That's how people get shot. That's how bad things happen. He goes, no. And he goes, why? He goes, well, I just wondered. And they kind of discussed it and they were like, I don't know what that was. So they, you know, looked everywhere they could look at night. There's no vehicles. And when I say no vehicles, I mean miles. And he said where they were parked to get to any vehicle to be able to drive to another part of that road was, you know, miles and miles away.
Yeah.
So they were out in the middle of nothing. And then that's what he come home and told me. He's like, I didn't see anything. I didn't smell anything. It was a crosswind. He goes, which is maybe what helped me. He goes, it couldn't smell me. I couldn't smell it. It only knew. And I said, well, then how did it know to whistle at you? He said, well, I got to thinking about that because when I asked him that, and he said that earlier in the day in that same draw when they had got there, they'd been hunting in that draw for about 4 hours that day. When they first got there, they'd put a stalk on one and they broke up. They'd split up. And my brother-in-law told my son, whistle when you get set up, when you get into your little area that you want to get in some brush and whistle to me. And that's what Brandon did. When he got there, he whistled to my brother-in-law, and my brother-in-law knew then that he could start walking. And he said, so whatever it was mimicking that whistle.
Right. It's been eavesdropping on the two of them the whole time.
Well, exactly. Whatever it was had been eavesdropping the entire time. And the way Brandon come across that draw, he's like, at one point, the wind had to blow towards it. So it smelt him. So maybe it had smelt him before when he made that sound. It linked him to that smell. I don't know. And that sound, and then it whistled back at him when it got close. I don't know what was going on. And Brandon don't know. He's like, man, it might have been somebody messing around. You know, I don't know. He's like, I don't think it was because I never saw a flashlight come on. I never saw anything. Nobody ever pushed through the brush. Nobody ever kicked a rock or stumbled, any of that.
Well, you'd have to be very foolish to go out and start jacking with hunters.
I mean,
I mean, that's right. You're looking to get killed.
You're looking to get thorned.
Man, I don't know what he saw. What was it?
Yeah,
was it one of these goat men we were talking about? Was it a Sasquatch?
I don't know. And he won't say. He's just like, it was a sound. It was a whistle. He said, all
spirit,
I got was a whistle.
You know, like a skinwalker.
Maybe.
Man, that is spooky.
Yeah. So it was, he's like, man, I don't know what to say, Pop. I just had to come home and tell you about it. So he was all like, and like I said, you ask him now, he's like, I don't know. I mean, he doesn't assume anything. You know, it's one of those, he's like, I don't know. All I know is it was a whistle and I can't put it together. So
man,
I got no clue.
When I was younger, I used to hunt all the time. And of course, I was still into the same stuff that I'm into now. Cryptozoology and things, and it didn't really bother me as much now. Once I've started this podcast and I've heard all the crazy stories and I've read all the crazy stories that people have emailed to me, I'm telling you, it's harder to go hunting now. I really do sit there alone sometimes and your mind starts racing. What is that?
Well, and the problem that I have too is we have some really good friends that do a lot of research into cryptozoology, that some write books and some are just, you know, doing the research, and we've talked to and even interviewed most of them too, and that they've talked to us off air and things that we can't air. You know, we've got stories that they've told us, and it's the stories that we can't air are the ones to me that are the most upsetting.
Yeah.
There's a few that, and I'm sure that we will in the next year or so, hopefully be able to get them out. There's a couple of them I would like to be able to get the okay from the people that happened to air, but they are some that's very, very disturbing. And that's just one of those things, as I'm with you, as I used to not think anything of it. I used to be in the woods. I was like, I'm the king of the woods, you know, as I'm walking through there. And I don't feel that way so much anymore.
Man, that is truly terrifying.
Right, so that's what happened. It didn't happen to me. It happened to my son. But I don't know. I don't know what kind of encounter that was or whatnot. But it was just interesting. So I wanted to share that with y'all.
Yeah, man, that's neat. Well, if you have any stories of your own out there and you would like to share them with me and Cam, don't forget you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. If you're new to the show, you can follow the website, expandedperspectives.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter. You know what to do, people.
Yeah.
Rate and review the show, please. We enjoy the reviews and the ratings we've been getting. We've been getting several more.
Yes.
And please continue to do that. Don't forget, if you like Expanded Perspectives, we offer an elite show every Thursday. And I have to fess up. Don't forget, you can always call the show, too, if you want to just talk to us or tell others why they should listen to Expanded Perspectives, and you might find your voice being played on one of our episodes. We have the phone number, and I didn't realize it wasn't working.
Right.
I got an email from somebody just the other day saying, hey, man, I've been trying to call you, and your service isn't working. I'm like, what is this guy talking about?
You're like, of course it is.
I was wondering why I haven't gotten any messages in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I went, and sure enough, we had to re-up the Skype number. It had expired, and I never got an email or nothing letting me know. So it's my fault. If you've been trying to call in,
sorry,
it's all on me. But now, if now it's working again, you can call in. That number is, Cam,
817-945-3828. So, yeah, hit us up. We'll play y'all on the show. Call us in. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you just want to give a shout-out to the show or all that stuff. Yeah, it's 817-1, of course. You can do 1-817-945-3828.
That's right. Yeah. Well, everybody, try to have a good week. Don't work too hard. If you're an elitist, we will speak to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday.
Be safe. Peace.